Between client meetings, managing your business, and everyday tasks, who has time to worry about website hosting? With Kinsta's Managed WordPress hosting, you don't have to. They handle the technical stuff, delivering lightning-fast load times, enterprise-grade security, and 24/7, 365 human-only support. Simply switching to Kinsta can make your site up to 200% faster. Kinsta's custom dashboard makes managing sites easy, with powerful features designed to save you time and effort. Plus, their free expert-led migrations ensure a smooth transition. Ready to see why Kinsta is trusted by thousands of businesses? Get your first month free at kinsta.com. That's KINSTA.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
Life can be chaotic. If you're running a retail business, don't let disorganized order fulfillment add to the chaos. Use ShipStation instead. With ShipStation, you never have to worry about shipping and fulfillment again. Whether you're running a business out of your garage or you have multiple warehouses, ShipStation is ideal for every phase of your business's growth. Save time with one login for all your stores and by automating repetitive tasks. Plus, you'll save money with the best shipping rates from global carriers. ShipStation's industry-leading features help you deliver a better customer experience. They'll get accurate and faster shipments, along with automated tracking updates with your branding. And with up to 88% off UPS and USPS rates, and up to 90% off FedEx rates, ShipStation is the fastest and most affordable way to ship. Calm the chaos. Switch to ShipStation today. Start a free trial at ShipStation.com/audio. That's ShipStation.com/audio.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's find a conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we're very excited to welcome back to the podcast today my old friend, Lydia Walker. Lydia is presently the assistant professor and assistant professor at Myers Chair in Global Military History at The Ohio State University. And she's also the author of States in Waiting, a counter-narrative of global decolonization. Lydia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Danny and Derek, for having me.
No problem. The pleasure is all ours. Why don't we start with the basic question, which is two things. One, what made you want to write this book? What in the field was exciting about it to you? And then kind of from there, its subtitle is a counter-narrative of global decolonization. So I think a good first question is, what narrative is it countering? And what is your story adding to the history of global decolonization that we didn't already know?
So after undergraduate, I worked at a think tank in New Delhi. And I did that because I wanted to understand some things about how the world worked and looked from a very different perspective. And while I was there, I realized that India is full of what we might call autonomous movements, what I've called states in waiting, anti-state, ethno-nationalist linguistic movements within. That it's almost better to think of India as like a continent like Europe than a sort of unitary country in some ways. And as I was sort of getting this sort of on-the-ground education of Indian domestic and sort of security politics, because I was at a think tank, the Institute of Peace and Conflict Studies there, that's focused specifically on regional security issues, I was starting to put these two things together, India's internal challenges and its security environment. And nowhere does this kind of overlap more specifically than the Indian Northeast. Northeast India is the region of India that now borders Myanmar and hangs over what's now Bangladesh. Of course, in 1947, when India becomes independent, Myanmar is Burma, Bangladesh is East Pakistan, and this is a region that's in sort of, is basically created, in made into a periphery by many, multiple partitions. That's sort of a separate conversation. But I became aware of this region and its contentious relationship with New Delhi. And this was kind of crystallized in a particular moment where I was at a conference, as budding academics often are, and have these find out interesting things and sometimes less interesting things. But in this particular moment, one of the speakers was a former Indian military police officer who'd spent his career in the Northeast. And he said, on the record, that regarding the Northeast, leaving everything up to the government seems colonial. And someone in the audience tweeted this. This was back in 2010. And within an hour, practically, it was very quick, my think tank received a personal phone call from the Indian Minister of External Affairs saying, and that's like the equivalent of the U.S. Secretary of State, saying, what are you talking about? You don't get to call something colonial in a post-colonial state, particularly India, the card-carrying exemplar of peaceful, successful national liberation. And I thought, oh, wow, I have a research question. What does it mean to call something colonial in a post-colonial state? And not just any, but India, the card-carrying exemplar of peaceful, successful national liberation. So my dissertation research and the book that is States in Waiting really kind of came out of trying to answer that question. And to answer that question regionally, but specifically globally. And what does it mean when you put one of these internal, supposedly, or coded as internal autonomous demands within the politics, the global politics of decolonization after the Second World War. So that's, I think, a kind of long way to answer the first question. The second question, I think, is quite interesting because the primary title has almost always been States in Waiting. It's been States in Waiting for quite some time, but I kept changing the subtitle. And for a while, it was Decolonization and Its Discontents. And then right before sort of production, this is kind of the last moment to really change things, I changed it to a counter-narrative of global decolonization. And I did it as I was revising the conclusion, sort of the last kind of bit. And I realized that's what the book really was. It was a counter-narrative, and it's a counter-narrative, not the. There are many others, and this is sort of one. And what is it, a counter-narrative between?
Right, that was my next question.
Sorry,
yeah.
Go, Danny.
Yeah. Like, what are the main narratives of globalization? I'm sorry, of decolonization and subsequently globalization, but what are like the main things that people argue about that in the field or just generally speaking?
I mean, I think these are more general public narratives, and they are ones that have more purchase outside of the United States because, and we can talk about this, about how the U.S. is an empire and how it's different than European empires. But the two that I see are of national celebration. I mean, the sort of the way I teach South Asian history is British Empire begins and ends with a famine in Bengal. And the empire was incredibly extractive and coercive, but not everywhere. It was also really uneven. And so part of the point of States in Waiting is to get at that unevenness and messiness and how different communities had different imperial and therefore post-colonial histories. So the first narrative is of nationalist celebration, and it's a narrative for very good reason. But it also means that new nationalist governments, they control their state archives. They have had a significant impact on how their histories get written. So that's the first. And the second, which you probably see more substantially in the public sphere in the UK right now, is of imperial nostalgia, where critiques of the dominant nationalist narrative of decolonization then flip into, oh, empire really wasn't that bad. and finding ways to sort of justify empire through kind of a balance sheet approach. So those are the two, what I see as the two dominant narratives of global decolonization. And one of an important aspect of States in Waiting is to chart a different one. One that was very visible to the people at the time. Not one that is is an invisible history that I'm unearthing. No, one that people at the time were very clearly and visibly grappling with.
So I think just leading from that, before we get into Naga nationalism and how you came across this particular movement, or what you term a transnational advocacy network. So what is focusing on States in Waiting, you know, just reveal from a macro level that we didn't understand before? And what does it feel about processes of the decolonization in the second half of the 20th century? And sort of what new apertures does it open up by focusing on States in Waiting?
So, I mean, a fundamental sort of aspect of my thinking is that exclusions are definitions. So communities, peoples, concepts that are excluded from dominant narratives actually define them. So, you know, it's not just who becomes a UN member state after 1945, after 1948, after 1960. It's who doesn't become a UN member state that defines who is a UN member state. So the concept of a state in waiting, and it's my own term, so it's not an actor's category, but it's a category that my interlocutors have found meaning in, have sometimes resonates for them. So it's maybe an actor empathetic category. And for me, sovereignty has two aspects. The first is a internal claim, self-determination. And the second is external recognition. And so it's those two facets working together. And so what about claims that don't receive the second? And I use the passive voice on purpose there, something that a people receives or is granted to them. And so a state in waiting is a sort of purposefully capacious term for those movements that don't receive independence or have not yet received independence. Start and end dates are arguments, and it's something I think all of us are quite cognizant of in our teaching, but I don't necessarily think it's often sort of crystallized in historical writing. And Namibia, a movement that I talk about a fair amount in States in Waiting, becomes independent in 1990. But in the mid-1960s, Namibia is very much a state in waiting. So, this isn't a term that holds across all time and all place. A community can be a state in waiting and a region during one period of time and then not in others.
So let's move to the major focus of your book, which is Naga nationalism. And so how did you come across these people, this group? And let's just start with the beginning, which is in this Burma, India, China theater, which is something that I became actually acutely aware in my own research. You know, this was a major theater that people were traveling to and trying out new things. And it's kind of overlooked, obviously, because it's not the European theater or the Pacific theater. But it's this other important place. So where did Naga nationalism come from? How did it emerge from the war? And let's tell this story.
So there are I argue there's kind of three major forces that explain how Nagas are understood from the outside and nationalize them over time. But these aren't necessarily the causes of Naga nationalism. A lot of that is intrinsic and is something for Nagas to define, not for myself as an outside scholar. And these are the experience of Christian conversion, the experience of the Second World War, and also anthropological definition. So there hasn't been an Indian census since 2011. So these figures are not I wouldn't cite them, but I would use them as ballpark kind of framing But Nagas are 90% Christian and 70% Jet Baptist. For comparison, Mississippi is 34% Baptist. So Nagas are, that makes Nagas the most Baptist state in the world. And they're a state within the Indian Union, when I'm saying that. Just like Mississippi is a state within the United States. And and they're Baptist because of American Baptist missionaries who became there from the 1880s onwards. Never very many, but they had a significant impact. And even though most Naga Baptist conversion happened from Naga missionaries, and especially after the Second World War, this is a significant aspect of Naga identity. And perception of feeling different from mainland India, meaning the rest of the Indian subcontinent. If you were, we had a map of India, we would see that the Northeast is adjoined to mainland India by a very thin strip of land, the Silbri Corridor, and in Indian strategic circles, this is called the chicken's neck because it can always be snapped. So it's a place of strategic vulnerability. So the Nagas, they're very Baptist, and Baptist conversion really rises significantly because of being bombed during the Second World War. So Danny mentioned this. The Naga capital of Kohima is the site of a major battle of the Second World War, the battles of Imphal and Kohima, which are several month-long sieges in which the Japanese are halted by the Allies. This is predominantly the British colonial army on the ground, but these are sieges, and they are won through American air support of American planes flying out of Kolkata predominantly and dropping supplies. Also, the trains in the Northeast during the Second World War are run by the U.S., so this is something I often cover in my teaching, is that CBI, the China-Burma-India Theater, which is what the U.S. call it, is very much, a part of American history of the Second World War as well as British or Indian. And Nagas fight on both sides. The Naga nationalist leader, Angami Sapubizo, allies with the Indian National Army, allies with the Japanese. But many Nagas are part of partisan units that fight for the British. And their sort of intermediaries are anthropologists and British colonial officials, and sometimes even American missionaries. And so these people serve as intermediaries in the subsequent years between Nagas and accessing newspaper coverage, getting visas, all the things that kind of allow a claim like this to enter international politics. And I could talk about the anthropology more, but Nagaland is very much what Bernard Cohen calls anthropology land. It's one of the best studied peoples of the late 19th and early 20th century before real violence breaks out in the region in a very significant way in the 1950s and really is ongoing until through the 1990s. So it's not very well studied during that period of time. But before the 1950s, there are many, many anthropology books written by people like Verrier Elwin, Christoph Heimendorf, and others who are very important in the field of anthropology during that period. And Elwin even writes, is Nehru's advisor for tribal peoples. And he writes, there's a list in the Indian constitution of tribes that have particular protections and a particular relationship with the Indian state. And Elwin writes that. So the place of Nagas as a tribal people constructed and understood in that way by anthropology is another way that Nagas that are defined externally.
Can we maybe talk a bit about this, a little bit more about the anthropology and about the structure of Naga society. And I'm particularly interested in the notion of a Naga nationalism and versus kind of my you know, very basic understanding here is that there are a number of tribes in this region, and they're all somewhat distinct from one another. And I'm curious when we can trace the idea of this being one people. Has that always been there, or is it something that develops over time? Like, what does the research say about that?
So this is a subject of significant debate within Nagaland today among Nagas. And because, you know, different tribal communities have different languages. I should say up front that tribe is an Indian constitutional category, and I'm using it in that way, and that it has very different sense in North American and African and other geographic contexts. So, you know, whether Nagas are Nagas or whether they are Aos, Semas, Lotas, Angamis is a real question of debate then and now. And I'm not here to give a sort of external definition of that. That's a question for Nagas themselves to consider. That said, we also have to think about the structures that define people in different ways. And the Indian census doesn't count Nagas. They count Angamis, Semas, Aos, and the many other tribal communities. And therefore, I mean, I open the book one of the first chapter of the book discussing about how it's really hard to know how many Nagas there are. And that's because the structures of the post-colonial states of India and Myanmar are deliberately set up not to count them. I'm sometimes asked by Chinese researchers whether they're Nagas in China. And I say, please find out and let me know. There most likely are. We don't know. There's a lot of things about this region that we don't know, and we don't know because of the structures of decolonization and post-colonial politics that make it so these are not questions that the, you know, governments of India, Myanmar, and China want us to know. And this is not unique to Nagas. This is how there are lots of communities in what are often called borderlands regions, or that have been a kind of discounted and therefore miscounted by post-colonial states.
It's a new year, 2025, and you're probably thinking, how am I going to make this year different? How can I make this the best year ever? How am I going to build something for myself? I'm dying to be my own boss or see if I can turn this business idea I've been kicking around into a reality. But I don't know how to make that happen. Shopify is the key, and let me tell you how. The best time to start your new business is right now. Shopify makes it simple to create your brand, open for business, and get your first sale. Get your store up and running easily with thousands of customizable templates. No coding or design skills required. All you need to do is drag and drop. Their powerful social media tools let you connect all your channels and create shoppable posts and help you sell everywhere people scroll. Shopify makes it easy to manage your growing business. They help with details like shipping, taxes, and payments from one single dashboard, allowing you to focus on the important stuff, like growing your business. What happens if you don't act now? Will you regret it? What if someone beats you to the idea? Don't kick yourself when you hear this again in a year because you didn't do anything now. With Shopify, your first sale is closer than you think. Established in 2025. Has a nice ring to it, doesn't it? Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle to start selling with Shopify today. shopify.com/redcircle.
If you're running a retail business, don't let disorganized order fulfillment cause chaos. Use ShipStation instead. From running a business out of your garage to multiple warehouses, ShipStation is ideal for every phase of your growth. Save time with one login for all your stores and by automating tasks. Plus, you'll get the best shipping rates from global carriers. Calm the chaos with the shipping software that delivers. Start a free trial at ShipStation.com/audio. That's ShipStation.com/audio.
89% of business leaders say AI is a top priority. But with AI tools popping up everywhere, how do you separate the helpful from the hype? The right choice is crucial, which is why teams at one-third of Fortune 500 companies use Grammarly. With over 15 years of experience building responsible, secure AI, Grammarly isn't just another AI communication assistant. It's how companies like yours increase productivity while keeping data protected and private. Designed to fit the needs of business, Grammarly is backed by a user-first privacy policy and industry-leading security credentials. This means you won't have to worry about the safety of your company information. Grammarly also emphasizes responsible AI, so your company can avoid harmful bias. See why 70,000 teams and 30 million people trust Grammarly at grammarly.com/enterprise. That's grammarly.com/enterprise. Grammarly, enterprise-ready AI.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about Ngami Zapufizo and what his role in the movement is and how he came to be, what were his ideological priors, where did he come from, and how he made this fight international.
So yeah, so Fizo is a really interesting character. He's born in British India. He's missionary educated, and he has English. That's another aspect of missionary education, is that you end up having particular elites, particularly in the Kohima region, that that speak, read, and write English, though most Navas don't necessarily during this period. And Fizo actually gets a job as a Bible and catalog salesman working out of Kolkata, sort of touring the region, selling Bibles. He starts kind of what one might call preaching national self-determination. He's doing this a bit before the Second World War. Then he then gets transferred to Rangoon, Yangon, and during the war, as the war is happening, the Japanese, capture it, and he then allies with the Japanese. Whether he specifically fought in the Second World War, I do not know. But when he returns to the Naga Hills following the war, he's wearing his INA uniform, and he receives a significant amount of kind of stature from that. And talked to interlocutors who knew him and heard him, and he was very charismatic. A lot of his kind of speeches were about national self-preservation. There's this great anecdote I found where he, this is from oral histories, where he'd cut soap into strips and tell people to always use it vertically so it would last longer. And soap would be an expensive imported item that would require, engagement with external actors. So it was about kind of holding on to resources and not letting outsiders control you. It's kind of my gloss on that anecdote that I've heard several times. So Fizo returns, and other people have written about this, but there's a wave of Asian anti-colonial nationalists who ally with the Japanese against empire. And Fizo is especially in what I believe Chris Bailey and Tim Harper have called the crescent of revolution from Kolkata to Singapore. And Nagaland is smack in the middle of that. I mean, that's one of the interesting things here, is that during this period, Nagaland is not a periphery. The Second World War makes it a center. So Fizo, in that, the experience of war. And then decolonization happens, and suddenly, and it's a periphery again. And Fiso returns, and he is preaching national self-determination. Now, Nagas had been calling for something like this in decades prior. There are a group of Nagas who actually fought as military laborers during the First World War, who return home after the war. They try to join the British Officers Club. They are not allowed for reasons of race and service hierarchy. And they form their own club, the Naga Club. They publish a newsletter that's called the Naga Nation in the 1930s. So this is kind of the backstory for the kind of rise of Naga nationalism. And Bezos, you know, inherits that. And when India becomes independent in August 1947, it's very important to Naga nationalist narrative making that they declared independence the day before. So they're not a secessionist movement in their nationalist narrative making. And they sent a telegram to the United Nations, and they received a literal receipt from that telegram. Now that receipt's been lost. But this narrative isn't about this being literally factually accurate and that I have the specific sources to back it up. It's more about how a people constructs a nationalist narrative and the role of the prospect of international recognition plays in that.
So then how does Fiso move within these transnational spaces? And this might be a good place to introduce Michael Scott, as he becomes an important character in particular. And maybe you could also introduce Jayaprakash Narayan. And so how does Fiso interact with them, and how do they enter the story here?
Yeah, so Michael Scott is a British Anglican minister, anti-apartheid activist. He's not the character in The Office. I often have to say that when I talk about Michael Scott. So Fiso there is a first Indian general election. The Nagas boycott it, so they're literally not counted. Insurgency breaks out in the region. The Indian military comes in, and Fiso is not doing so well. His party is not doing so well. And there also are Naga moderates who want to strike the best deal they can with the Indian government. And Fiso, so he's kind of losing a grip on Naga politics. So in the late 1950s, he literally walks to East Pakistan. And he spends a couple years there. And then in 1960, he ends up in Zurich, and he's transported by the Pakistanis. But he allegedly has a fake El Salvadorian passport that was procured for him by one of his nephews, who was an epidemiology student studying in Chicago. Now, this Charlie Aralu. Now, Charlie read an op-ed in the New York Times about how the Herero people of Southwest Africa and Namibia were petitioning the United Nations through the advocacy of Reverend Michael Scott. And Charlie thought, this is something that a small people can do. This is how a small people can reach international politics. So he worked through a network that involved the anthropologist Laura Thompson, who had taught Charlie's wife at University of North Carolina. I'm telling this story in somewhat detail because it's this kind of incremental network of individuals and how they reach out to each other, which is how a people enters international politics. So there's the individual advocates, and then there's the people the community that's trying to engage in nationalist claims making and how that relationship works. Laura Thompson reaches out to Michael Scott, and she had done similar advocacy work on behalf of of communities in Melanesia, where she had been an anthropologist employed by the U.S. military during the Second World War. So I talk about the Nagas quite specifically, but you can make you can trace similar relationships between claims making and advocacy that involve issues of anthropology, war, and religion for many communities across the world during this period. So Michael Scott, after some agonizing, because the reason why he got to the UN in the first place to speak on behalf of Southwest Africa and Namibia was through the entree of the Indian delegation at the UN. He is really good friends with Indian politicians like Vijay Lakshmi Pandit, who's India's ambassador to the United Nations, and also the Indian civil society leader, Jayaprakash Narayan. Some people may have heard of JP because he emerges as Indira Gandhi's sort of great opponent during the Indian emergency in the late 1970s. During the 1950s, the U.S. State Department thinks JP is going to be Nehru's successor as Indian prime minister. Now, that says a lot more about American misunderstanding of Indian politics than JP's actual political position within India. But it also is illuminative of JP's wider international profile. He had been active in the Indian independence movement. After the Indian independence movement, he leaves formal politics. And he's a leader, one of the leaders of sort of an Indian post-Gandhi civil society peace movement. And he's actively engaged in a global nonviolent protest in support of anti-colonial nationalism. But this doesn't extend to peoples within India, and nor does it extend to peoples within India who engage in outright insurgency. So JP and Scott, while they can work on a host of other issues, particularly on the decolonizing African continent, which I focus on in the book, the Naga issue really kind of fractures their working relationship and the wider network of advocates drawn from the international peace movement that support anti-colonial nationalist claims in international politics. I'm talking, I think, a little potentially at too much length here, but I want to briefly say that an important aspect of this is that after 1945, the United Nations, in order to speak of the United Nations, you need to be brought in the room by a state. And or you need to be an accredited non-governmental organization that has UN credentials. There's a whole kind of politics of credentialization and access to the United Nations that really empowers these advocates to speak on behalf of particular communities. At the same time, these advocates who are missionaries, anthropologists, activists, sometimes even political economists, need to be brought in the room by a state. So they are both empowered by the fact that they're speaking on behalf of non-state actors, and they themselves are not necessarily representing states, but that they can't really do what they do except for their connections to states.
And so I think this is actually a perfect place to go into the next chapter of your book, which has this great title, The Anti-Algiers. And we could talk about the foundation of this World Peace Brigade, and it might be even worth just for listeners, I'd like to hear your reflections on like transnational advocacy and what is happening at this time, because it's interesting because like obviously we came up in a time when non-state actors were being studied a lot in the American historical profession, but there's the irony that oftentimes the influence or the locus of non-state actors' influence is the state itself. So there's this tension there. So maybe you could talk about like the importance of focusing on non-state actors and transnational advocacy networks and how this World Peace Brigade came to be and why it's important.
Yeah. So the way the book's organized is the first part is this almost vertical axis, of how a nationalist claim enters international politics, looking at the Navas first in the region and then when Fizeau arrives in London. I don't believe I quite said that it was Michael Scott who brought Fizeau to London, and he literally brings him in under the category of former imperial citizen, which is not a legal category, and he walks him through immigration because he's like 6 feet tall and he has a priest dog collar and no one's going to say boo. That's not how British immigration works these days. But that's part of this kind of fluidity of decolonization where something like that is literally possible. So Scott and JP with the American activist A.J. Mustey, who's sort of quite well known for his work with the U.S. Civil Rights Movement, his mentorship of Bayard Rustin, and a very kind of, and also his work with U.S. organized labor, and a very prominent member of sort of American religious left organizations and sort of operations. In 1961, they found an organization called the World Peace Brigade, and it's literally set up in order for decolonization to escape what they call its entrapment of violence. And part of it is like they're seeing what's happening in Congo, the Congo crisis of 1960 onwards, and the limits of an official UN intervention and what UN peacekeepers can and cannot do. And they think that, you know, civil society, unarmed peacekeepers kind of parachuted in or walking across national and international borders can do stuff that the United Nations itself cannot. At the same, and them being disinterested, unaligned civil society leaders can do stuff that representatives of state governments cannot. At the same time, how they actually access stuff is because they are actually connected to politicians and political leaders in their home countries. I mean, JP is the tightest, or his relationship with Nehru is charged, but they talk regularly. Musty and Scott are not as intimately connected with their national leadership, though Musty is one of the sort of few who can on the left in the U.S. during the 1960s, who's still perceived of as safe by kind of a mainstream liberal politicians. And this could be an interesting conversation about the role of religion here, because all of them are religious figures and viewed as kind of faith leaders in certain ways in their countries, and how this makes them sort of perceived of as safe by more establishment types, but also have legitimacy among the disenfranchised communities they're working with.
Yeah, let's delve a little bit into that. And then I would also like to talk about Dar es Salaam and what this whole concept of the anti-Algiers was.
So, I mean, Dar es Salaam is literally, I think, abode of peace in Arabic. So calling Dar es Salaam the anti-Algiers is kind of a riff on that. Now, Algiers, this is also a riff on Jeff Burns' book, The Mecca of Revolution, and how Algiers becomes this hub of support for anti-colonial nationalist movements, particularly military training. Now, the World Peace Brigade, Scott, JP, and Musty, their first big project is this Africa Freedom Action Project, which they launched in 1962 in Dar. They basically want to provide training for nationalist movements in nonviolent civil disobedience tactics. And they're invited in by Nyerere, by Julius Nyerere, but he kind of ignores them. And their big sort of project is supporting Kenneth Kaunda's ascension to leadership and also the independence of Zambia, which becomes independent in 1964. And the Scott was supposed to be there for much of the project. He really wasn't, and leadership really was Bayard Rustin and Bill Sutherland, who are more famous as U.S. civil rights leaders really kind of run the project. And so it's also interesting to think about how the connection, both in terms of personnel and ideas and exchange between the U.S. civil rights movement and this network for anti-colonial advocacy that is a part of the international peace movement. I talk about this later in the book, but it's very interesting that this story really drops away while, you know, the work that Ruskin and Sutherland do on U.S. civil rights is much better known. So this, they plan a march with Kaunda from it's still Tanganyika, then it'll become Tanzania, but it's still Tanganyika, to Zambia. And this march never happens because Kaunda pulls the plug. And he pulls the plug because his negotiations with the British are going so well. So he does it as kind of a good faith gesture to London. And he basically uses the World Peace Brigade as leverage with his negotiations for independence. So in some ways you could say, oh, well, then this was really actually really successful, even though they didn't do anything, because they did help Zambia become independent quite quickly. And they helped Kaunda kind of prove his anti-colonial nationalist and pacifist and multiracial bona fides by being sort of the right kind of independence leader at that time. However, because they don't do anything, it really kind of undermines their reason to exist. So one of the aspects that I kind of explore in the book is I discuss the World Peace Brigade as an entity because it's where Scott, JP, and Musty, and also Rustin, Sutherland, Suresh Ram, who's a prominent Indian activist during this period, and others meet. It's kind of this the official organization for their activities. But a lot of what they do as individuals is a lot more impactful than this organization. Other scholars have written about the World Peace Brigade and are working on the World Peace Brigade. Think of Jack Hodder and Caroline Stolte particularly. But it's not, when I started working at it on it, very few people knew what I was talking about. And there's a reason why, because they don't do much. So part of what was kind of really sort of interesting writing about them is how do you show the impact of an organization that doesn't achieve its aims? And part of that I got at was really the relationship between the organization and the individual, and that these individual advocates themselves had tremendous influence. But when they formed an organization, it did not. So that's kind of an internal contradiction in movement politics with the World Peace Brigade.
So this might actually be a good place to conclude this conversation, because we're going to have you back again to talk about the rest of the story you tell. But what is this? I think it's important to actually take a step back and talk about like transnational advocacy and non-state actors. And so what is your story? Because they've been being studied now in our field for 20 plus years. So I think like it's a good place to sort of like reconceive about what are they do. Are they as important as states? Are they not as important as states? Could you talk a little bit about sort of the methodological things that emerge from focusing so much on transnational advocacy? And we're now entering the third decade of studying non-state actors, so I think it's probably a good time for reflection.
Yeah, so, I mean, transnational advocacy network, which is a term I use, is a term coined by, I think, Margaret Keck and Catherine Sicking. Decades ago, I should look at the citation. But
political scientists, right? Political scientists of human rights, mostly. And Sarah Snyder uses similar concept in her work on Selma and international civil rights. So it's been, I think, an important category in the field for a bit now. Yeah,
very much so. I think it's important that it's a category that political scientists started, and specifically political scientists who are working on human rights started, because they're interested in like what human rights organizations today can do to be more successful. Well, I mean, historians are motivated by all sorts of things, but I'm the kind of historian who's interested in exploring past narratives and understanding how they're constructed, and not necessarily in looking forward towards what future organizations can learn specifically from that. I think the relationships between the two are a lot more complex and could be many, many other conversations rather than this question. But state versus non-state. I think an aspect of this that I'm continuously drawn to is that they're intimately connected. And I said this earlier with states in waiting, where the state-making process of decolonization is being defined to a large extent by the places and peoples it excluded. What are states is also defined in part by what is the non-state. And realms that are handled by non-state actors are often, well, sometimes it's because states are actually empowering them but don't want to be seen to. Sometimes it's because states don't actually want to deal with these issues at all, and don't want to waste time on them. And therefore, what kind of empowers non-state actors is like state lack of interest. So this both empowers non-state actors to actually have space to do stuff, but it disempowers them long-term because there's not really much to do. So the relationship between the state and non-state in, let's say, 20th century political history writ large is intimately connected. And I don't think they can be fully separated. I mean, I talk about transnational advocacy because I wanted to talk about nationalist claims making. And that was the space to do it because that's how claimants navigated international politics. I did not go in to work on transnational advocacy specifically. It became sort of a way to talk about claimants because of where archives are located and what's necessary in order to access international politics. So it's almost kind of a symptom of this issue that half the book is on transnational advocacy, and that the book is really about this unstable intersection between claims making and its advocacy and how they're kind of mutually dependent, but also in some ways, I argue, mutually undermining.
I mean, that's a really perfect way to end this conversation. We'll lead very nicely into the next one. Lydia, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to have you back to finish up the rest of the story. But everyone, if you're interested in the subject of decolonization, looked at from a slightly different perspective than it has traditionally been looked at, please check out States in Waiting. Lydia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.